Here we go. Welcome to the virtual John Jay Homestead and the second of our 2021 Zoom Talks. I'm Melissa Vail, trustee of the Friends and chair of the Lectures Committee. One of the advantages of this Zoom era is that we didn't spend all day sweating the plowing of our small parking lot, but we do miss seeing you all in person. First, some webinar logistics. You're all muted and video of you is turned off. If you have technical problems, please use the chat function for messages to your host and our ED, Emily Grand. After an introduction, Professor Shapiro will talk. He's asked us to round up some questions from our committee to use to structure this hour, and you've given us some great ones, but we welcome more. Please use the raise hand feature on your Zoom screen. If you hit that, we'll announce and unmute you to the extent that we have time, and you'll get to ask your question yourself. Special thanks to our lectures committee for their indispensable support of these talks, and to our excellent public partner, the New York State Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, for everything. And as always, and most important, our members, who are our reason for being. Now, here's another advantage to Zoom: our ability to conduct a survey. I'm going to ask you two lightning questions. Which play do you think has the most to say to us in this unusual time? And which play do you think could be put on pause from the canon, at least temporarily? Please give us your choices right away, because Professor Shapiro will use them to start off his talk. It's multiple choice. There's no wrong answer. And it's okay if the talk makes you change your mind. Please vote. Then please keep an eye out for our third talk of the season, March 16th, Brenda Wineapple, award-winning author and professor at CUNY, the New School, and Columbia, with The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson, and The Dream of a Just Nation. Please join us for that. Now, those of you who've come to our talks before know that we always look for a Jay connection to the topic of the evening. John Jay was classically educated at King's College, now Columbia, and very familiar with Shakespeare. We have many of his volumes in our collection. And it's widely considered that his most important work was as a diplomat. In 1783, he negotiated the Treaty of Paris, ending the Revolutionary War and forcing Britain to recognize an independent United States. In keeping his negotiations hidden from France, he directly violated his instructions from Congress. The country proceeded for a while under the frustrating Articles of Confederation and then drew up a constitution. In 1788, Jay wrote several of the Federalist Papers urging the states to ratify, including number 64 about the power to make treaties. He wanted the Constitution to put the power to make treaties with the more decisive and autonomous President and Senate, rather than with the more political legislature. In number 64, he drew directly on Julius Caesar, expanding on the, quote, tide in the affairs of men, which, when taken at the flood, leads on to fortune, to get that autonomy over treaties. The Constitution was ratified. He became Chief Justice. And then in 1794, he was sent by George Washington to England to clean up some unfinished business from the Treaty of Paris. He had to work it out at a distance and with long delays in communication, and the result became known as the Jay Treaty. The Jay Treaty was intensely unpopular, being considered way too favorable to England. When Washington went for advice and consent from the Senate, there's a quaint notion, some of the provisions of the Jay Treaty were leaked to the public by political opposition, and outrage ensued. With wild rioting in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia, houses and ships being burned, Alexander Hamilton hit in the head with a rock, mobs charging through the streets with effigies and copies of the treaty held up on pikes, and George Washington being threatened with the guillotine and impeachment. The outrage did calm down. The treaty was finally approved by the Senate in a vote, a tie vote along party lines, finally broken by a breakaway voter. It was signed by Washington, and a do-over war with England was averted until the War of 1812, which the United States could by then win. So, is this moment today unprecedented? You tell me. Now, our speaker, James Shapiro, is the Larry Miller Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia and a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's a member of the board of directors of the Royal Shakespeare Company, the Shakespeare Scholar in Residence at the Public Theater in New York, and on the Council of the Authors Guild. This book was one of the New York Times' 10 best nonfiction books of 2020. He's written many other books, articles, and opinion pieces, and won multiple prizes and awards. Welcome to James Shapiro. Jim, we'll start off by sharing the results of our lightning surveys. Emily, how are we going to? Oh, there we go. Okay. Which play do you think best speaks to the moment? Macbeth. All right. You see the results. Emily, is everyone seeing these, or is it just us?
I'm seeing them as well.
You're seeing them as well. Okay. So Macbeth is the winner for the most relevant play at 34%. Richard II got nothing. I'm disappointed about that. And which play do you think should be put on pause from the canon? Taming of the Shrew and Othello are tied at 21% each, and Merchant of Venice only gets 10, and not actually not a single one gets 48%. There we go. And
Wow.
have a whole lot of non-members in this audience, which I think is a successful answer because that means we have a lot of building to do. So, Jim, tell us, are we wrong or what do you think?
Well, that's a great response and tells me something about the audience and its values. I really want to thank you for inviting me to participate tonight. I'm only sorry I didn't have a chance to visit in public your beautiful grounds and share with all of you this conversation in a kind of exchange. And I'm really counting on our opening this up in the last 10 minutes so that I can field more questions so that it'll have a bit more of a conversational nature. But for the first 15 minutes, I'd really like to sketch out some things that I've been thinking about and maybe give you a glimpse behind the book, behind the process that led to it, and some insight for those who may have read it and are curious about its formation. And I should say at the outset that the survey questions are great because in my work with the Public Theater, with the Royal Shakespeare Company, and with smaller companies, both in the US and the UK, I'm constantly asked, what play should we do next? Or what play should we avoid? I've never had the advantage of a survey that would answer these questions in this rapid way. But I'm delighted that so many of you think that Julius Caesar and Macbeth, especially, which came out on top, are the plays that speak to our moment. What's interesting to me in this response is, of course, the choices were somewhat limited. We didn't list King John, Henry VI, Part III, or other less popular plays that no one really either wants to censor or stage immediately. But the question for me is, what play speaks to a political moment 2 or 3 months from now? And I'm speaking to you all on a day in which the Senate is in session, listening to arguments about whether a president is to be impeached and really going back several hundred years in time to the kind of conflicts and divisions that Melissa described in her introduction. I don't know from the two prongs of the political moment and the pandemic moment which one should or will take precedence. And since I'm involved in conversations about what will be staged at the Delacorte Theater in Central Park this summer, I can tell you, and this is probably violating confidentiality, but I will tell you that They're leaning more towards comedy than politics. The political atmosphere is so heated, and the need for people to have a release from being locked up in their homes for so long for missing Shakespeare in the Park last summer. Comedy seems to be the play that most speaks to contemporaries. But were I to choose a play that speaks to the political moment, I would go with the majority here and I would say Macbeth. And I hope to return to Macbeth in the course of my remarks. As far as what play should be removed from the canon for a while, I see that Taming of the Shrew, Merchant of Venice, and Othello all had adherents from those of you listening in. And I think that is an astute judgment. For those who find Taming of the Shrew unbearable in its misogyny, in an ending in which a woman must put her hand beneath the foot of her husband and submit entirely, it's a painful play to read. It's a play I no longer teach. I don't think I've ever taught the play. I have worked on productions of it, and the challenges are nearly insuperable. The Merchant of Venice is a play near and dear to me, and I know of many Shakespeare scholars who feel that Merchant and Othello, the two Venice plays, should be retired from the stage for a while. They are just too inflammatory. They are just too disturbing to Blacks and to Jews. I have never taken this position. My position has been, and I wrote about it in a book called Shakespeare and the Jews, probably 25 or 30 years ago, that Shakespeare's plays are like a canary in a coal mine, which is to say, we breathe a toxic atmosphere, whether it is misogyny or racism or anti-immigration or all the things that divide us as a nation. We don't really do a very good job of speaking with each other. We tend to speak past each other if we speak at all on these issues. And I for one, need to know and to take the temperature of a community or really of a country at any given point. And the best way I find in doing so is to stage these plays. And if it turns out to be a really disturbing Othello or a truly disturbing Merchant of Venice, I'll be a little bit more aware of what is going on around me. And if I don't get to see these plays, if they're really removed from the canon and the stage for a while, I'm walking blind. I don't really have a strong enough sense of what the cultural divisions are. So I do have a point when I argue with fellow Shakespeareans about this. I do draw a line in the sand, and that line comes when there is violence. And that leads me to a couple of the chapters in my book. Let me begin with the story that frames Shakespeare in a divided America and was the impetus for writing the book. About a month after Donald Trump shocked many of us and shocked me and my community in New York City, the Upper West Side being a very liberal community, and won the election, I was called into the office of Oscar Eustis, who is the artistic director of the Public Theater in New York. And because I help directors with the cutting of the play and with rehearsing plays, and I work with the cast as well, he called me in to talk about doing Julius Caesar. And I was kind of surprised knowing that he had done it several times before. Not that he was doing it again, but that he needed my help at all. And this was one of those moments that which brought us to the moment. And for Oscar, it was going to be Julius Caesar. And in fact, the Public Theater had been thinking of doing Richard II, but parked that on the side, insistent on doing a play that somehow captured the moment. And I don't know how well all of you can move yourselves back in time to December of 2016, but it was unclear then whether Donald Trump was going to move to the center, was going to govern for everyone, was going to be a non-polarizing figure. Nobody really knew at the time. And nobody really understood at that time what the right was what was happening to the cultural right, to the political right in this country, certainly not in the ways that we can see now 4 years later. So this was a wonderful opportunity to explore how liberals were feeling and how conservatives were feeling, how those on the left and those on the right. And I should say Oscar Eustace is the only person I've ever met who carries in his wallet a communist, red Communist Party card, which was his mother's. His mother was a member of the Communist Party back in the 20s and 30s. So I kind of knew where he was coming from in this production from the outset, but I was wrong. Oscar really wanted to do something unusual with this production. He wanted to cause whiplash, and he wanted to do so by staging an assassination of a Donald Trump lookalike, long suit, long red tie, blonde hair, foreign speaking wife, in a way that would force his liberal audiences at the Delacorte in Central Park to question what it meant to remove by undemocratic means a democratically elected leader. And the brilliant thing he did, having as the artistic director of the Public an unlimited budget, or nearly so, he hired 50 young people in this modern dress production and spaced them out around the 1,900 people in the open air audience. And they sat there quietly watching the production until the moment where Brutus and the conspirators brutally, with knives in hand, assassinated Julius Caesar. And it was an extraordinary moment. It was extraordinary for a number of ways, in a number of ways. One was, after the Trump-like Caesar is sprawled and lying dead on the ground, on one or two nights, there'd be people who would applaud once or twice. And I kept waiting for the groundswell of applause to take over as it does at the end of a production. It never happened. They sat there quietly embarrassed by their visceral reaction. But the other thing that happened on every night was those 50 young people stood up in groups of one or two or three and started heckling the assassins, the conspirators, challenging Brutus, Cassius, and the others for what they had done. Nobody had ever tried this in the public theater before. People were looking around really anxiously. And since I knew this was a trick on the director's part, I was just really interested in the reaction of playgoers to, again, a sense of challenge, a sense of dialogue. And one of the questions that Melissa forwarded me from someone in the room right now, in this virtual room, is that I made a good point that the Elizabethan educational system taught debate and seeing two sides of an issue, and I'm quoting here. In the Public Theater, Julius Caesar in 2017, do you think the protesters had ever read the play, or are they just whipped up by social media? And how do we fix humanities education in the US? There are a lot of questions within that question forwarded, but it leads me to what happened next. Because someone watching that production complained about it on the right-wing media. And within a day or two, Fox had picked this up. The New York Times had picked this up. And all of a sudden, protesters were coming to the theater with the intent of disrupting and ending this production. And that was quite terrifying, because we don't even check bags when people enter the Delacorte Theater. And it takes about 2 seconds to run from the back of the theater onto the stage. And I was in the playhouse the night that the first protester rushed the stage and brought the action to a halt. And it was one of the most extraordinary moments I've ever experienced in a theater, because the stage manager said to the actors who were just milling around after the protesters were hauled off, pick it up from liberty, freedom, tyranny is dead. And the entire audience exploded in an applause, and the actors resumed what they were doing. But moments after that, the hecklers that were planted in the crowd began to heckle the actors on stage. And it was extremely terrifying and disorienting for the audience members who had just witnessed a real protest and now were witnessing a fake one. And the last week of this production, where more protesters came in, the FBI, the Secret Service, New York City Police, Park Service, the number of security forces there could have doubled the size of the crowd. No one got hurt. But what it did was teach me, again, going back to my canary in the coal mine argument, what it did teach me was theater has the capacity to anticipate, to sense what is bubbling up from below. And what was bubbling up from below at that time was extreme anger on the right and any insult to Donald Trump. They did not want an argument. They did not want a conversation. And Oscar Eustace and the rest of us on the creative team had completely misunderstood and underestimated the fury of the right and their willingness to resort to violence. And on January 6th, when the Capitol was attacked, I thought back to this moment. And I thought back as well to an earlier moment where Steve Bannon was addressing a group of those on the Christian right in 2000, let me see what date it was. Oh, it was in October 2017. And I'll quote Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's advisor at the time. And he's speaking to a group that was called the Values Voters Summit. Here's Steve Bannon. Up on Capitol Hill, it's like the Ides of March. The only question, and this is just an analogy, a metaphor, whatever you want to call it, they're just looking to find out who's going to be Brutus to your Julius Caesar. And he went on to advocate violence. And I was shocked that there was no pushback to this. Who was going to take out Mitch McConnell if they followed his advice? So the language was there, the desire for chaos was there, and it just took a little push for that to turn into something real. So the lesson for me is we really can't afford to silence any of these plays, no matter how disturbing they are. And I'll just digress for a moment from the subject of my book to describe a moment when I was in Israel 25 years ago, seeing a production of The Merchant of Venice. And it was in Hebrew, and Jews were playing Christians and Jews in this production. And my Hebrew was okay, and I know the play very well. And I was watching a transformation in Shylock from a secular Jew to somebody who became a radicalized West Bank settler who would spray his enemies with an imaginary Uzi and became angry and disaffected to the point of threatening violence. And 2 months after that production, a man assassinated about 100 yards from that theater, Yitzhak Rabin, the prime minister of Israel and an advocate of peace. And it struck me that the directors and the cast of that production felt something in the culture, felt something in the air that had not yet happened in much the same way that Oscar Eustace had done. So again, in responding to the initial question of the snap quiz or sampling, these plays are disturbing. There's no way around them, but they're also plays that give us access into some of the more complicated and divisive issues in this country. I'll shift from there to going back to the Founding Fathers, which is appropriate in a John Jay setting. And the Founding Father that most interested me was John Quincy Adams. I had whatever I remembered from high school social studies, I think they called it back in the day. We learned that he was a great abolitionist, that John Quincy Adams was the sixth president of the United States, that after serving as president, he went back into Congress to oppose the annexation of Texas and the expansion of slavery. And he was considered a fierce opponent of slavery, fought successfully the Amistad case in the Supreme Court. So I always thought he was just a good guy. And one of the things that I discovered in the course of writing this book was liberals harbor disturbing views, just as those who are conservative. And he offered a textbook case of how Shakespeare complicates the labels we put on people when it comes to divisive issues. John Quincy Adams may have been an opponent of slavery, but he couldn't wrap his head around a white woman sleeping with a black man. Now, he probably left more writing, longer diaries than any American who's ever lived. And he never spends a line in that writing on the question of miscegenation, or what was called in his day, amalgamation, that is, whites and blacks together. But one of the things that I learned in the course of researching this book was he was invited to the worst dinner party in the history of bad dinner parties. It was up in Boston in 1835, and he was seated next to the greatest Shakespeare actor of the day, Fanny Kemble, who had come over from England with her father and was touring up and down the East Coast, meeting with the president, meeting with very important people, and now seated next to the ex-president. She's in her early 20s, he's 66, and he spends the evening mansplaining Shakespeare to the greatest Shakespeare actor of the day. And what he didn't know was that she would go home just as he would go home and write a diary account of that evening. And her diary account described how shocked she was to hear him vilify Desdemona. And to his great shock, she published 2 years later her travels in America. And while leaving out John Quincy Adams' name, everybody who read this account knew that it was John Quincy Adams who was the mansplainer. And John Quincy Adams responded by writing two essays attacking the character of Desdemona. And they are just shocking. They're shocking because he comes out and says, she's no heroine. And in being suffocated and strangled at the end of the play, she gets what she deserves for marrying, falling in love with, and marrying a black man. And I teach this essay every year, and I'm shocked every time. I expect somehow the ending to be different because of what I think about John Quincy Adams. But for me, this is a kind of test case of the values all of us have that may not be the values we aspire to. And what was even more disturbing was Fanny Kemble later in life wrote another book and published it shortly after John Quincy Adams had died. And in it, she said that when he was describing Desdemona and Othello, he spoke of Othello in terms of the N-word. And I just couldn't wrap my head around a president of the United States using that word at a dinner conversation with somebody he had just met. So these are the ways in which, for me, Shakespeare becomes a way of teasing out what historians like Sean Valence, who has spoken with you and who has submitted a question I'll get to shortly, know but don't really underscore. So my book aspired to be an alternative history of the United States using Shakespeare to tease out some of the things that we never got to study in school. One of the questions that you have forwarded to me is, and I'll quote, "You make a fascinating point about the connections between riots and theater, urban density, class mixing, and inequality. And this brings me to yet another example of violence, the Astor Place riots." And I kind of knew a little bit about the Astor Place riots when I started to look into this question. And I'm kind of surprised when I meet people, including faculty, colleagues at Columbia, who say, "I loved your book. I never heard of the Astor Place riots." And they were one of the really signal events in New York in 1849. And they could have been a lot worse. In the end, when the militia fired on a crowd outside the Astor Place Opera House killing 20 and wounding 100, and both sides withdrew. The next day, the opposing forces of those aligned with those who were challenging the city and the authorities and the status quo, and those supporting law and order, faced off downtown in New York. And all of this occurred because of a conflict between two actors. Forrest, the great American Shakespearean who played Macbeth, and MacReady, the great British actor who also played Macbeth. And they were playing it at the same time in New York City, the same night. And Forrest stirred up his American supporters against this foreigner who was playing Macbeth in a very English and restrained and cerebral way. And they tried to destroy the theater. And it tells you that we are a country, unlike almost any other country, where we're willing to spill blood, if it comes to that, over Shakespeare. But it wasn't only Shakespeare. Shakespeare became, as this question points out, a catalyst for urban density, for income inequality, for the fact that New Yorkers had no place to let out their anger and energies and frustration. And this was not the only theater riot of its day. So again, I'm using this as an example of the ways in which pressures build up, and Shakespeare, who is embraced by the cultural left and the cultural right, becomes a way of working out these issues. Let me turn to the next anecdote that I want to share, or in a way, chapter that I want to describe briefly. And it was, for me, the most important chapter of the book, and one that kept fighting to be a book in and of itself, and I had to keep cutting it, and it kept growing, and I had to keep cutting it. And it was a chapter on how Abraham Lincoln and John Wilkes Booth, the man who assassinated him in, at Ford Theater in April 1865, made Shakespeare central to their lives, but central in different ways. And Lincoln, I discovered, turned out to be, although he never had formal education, except very little when he was a young man, he turned out to be the best reader of Shakespeare, the strongest reader, Harold would say, in American history. And I'm just humbled by the extent to which Abraham Lincoln immersed himself in Shakespeare's words, to the point, in fact, that he became something of a bore to his friends and associates and underlings, or the young men who operated the telegraph office during the Civil War, because Lincoln would use any opportunity and every opportunity to recite Shakespeare to anyone who would listen or was too polite to leave the room. And he clearly spent a lot of time reading it in his depressive way to himself. And as the war progressed, he turned more and more to Macbeth, because Macbeth seemed to him, in speeches like Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, a deeply, deeply distraught leader, one who is steeped in blood. And here, 600 or 700,000 Americans dead during this war were individuals Lincoln felt responsible for. What's so fascinating to me is John Wilkes Booth loved Macbeth no less than Lincoln. Born in Maryland, and identifying himself far more with the Confederacy than with the North, as his brother Edwin Booth had, John Wilkes Booth loved playing Macbeth. But the parts of Macbeth he loved were not the part of the character that was reflective or learn from his tragic experience, but rather the soldier warrior. And we have accounts of John Wilkes Booth touring the nation and only putting on Act 5 of Macbeth so he could cut right to the chase and have a fantastic fight scene with Macduff at the end of the play. And when John Wilkes Booth had assassinated Lincoln, was on the run for 10 days or so before Union troops surrounded and killed him, he wrote in his diary lines quoting from Macbeth. And you could just feel the ways in which this play weighed on both men. And when the nation had to grapple with the assassination of its president, collectively, it turned to Macbeth as well. And on street signs and buildings, and as Lincoln's body went by train across the country, signs were put up quoting from Shakespeare, but in particular, quoting those lines that Shakespeare had written about King Duncan, that remarkable king that Macbeth speaks those lines in the play. And Macbeth as a play became a way for America to grapple with the unthinkable, that is to say, the assassination of its president. So without going too deep into any individual example, I'm trying to really sketch out over two centuries from the founding fathers until this current moment, the ways in which Shakespeare has been essential to an American political and cultural experience in ways, to me, far more intense and violent and crucial than those in the United Kingdom. I want to turn in my next segment before we have 10 minutes at the end to open things up. And that is a question of Shakespeare going forward. And it's in part implied in the questions about which play should be removed from the canon or which should not. And here I speak as somebody who's closely involved with theater organizations and with scholarly organizations, living through a pandemic, living in the aftermath of a resurgent movement for social justice and for Black Lives Matter. And it is increasingly clear to companies performing Shakespeare on both sides of the Atlantic that the pre-pandemic Shakespeare cannot be the post-pandemic Shakespeare. And it is no less clear to those of us who teach Shakespeare in the classroom that the Shakespeare we once taught can no longer be identical to the Shakespeare we taught going forward. And in some ways, those changes will be visible. That is to say, the actors standing and speaking the plays will more closely resemble the full range of cultures, identities, and ethnicities in this country. Shakespeare will no longer just be spoken as it was when I was a child first seeing Shakespeare by all white companies. But that is clearly not enough. And in a post-pandemic world where things are very unclear as to what is changing and why things are changing, productions are going to race to catch up with those changes. In the classroom, clearly, voices that have not been heard will be heard. And that too is something that those of us who teach Shakespeare and teach American culture are attentive to. Back in 2014, I think, I don't remember exactly, the Library of America published a volume called Shakespeare in America that I edited for them. And there were many, many entries in this. And I tried to capture everything from Native Americans speaking about Shakespeare to Bill Clinton, who wrote very generously a foreword to my book. I wanted to capture really the full range of Americans. But I really failed in doing that. And I failed in doing that because I just didn't know enough. And if I ever get a chance to revisit that anthology and expand upon it, I know that there are changes that I will make. And one of those changes came because of the letter that, or the email that Melissa received from Sean Wilenz, the distinguished Princeton historian, who wrote to me, and I'll quote, "You've written powerfully about how Othello brought out racial tensions within John Quincy Adams. But in honor of William Jay, the great anti-slavery constitutionalist, could you say a little bit more about the connections between Shakespeare and American anti-slavery, as well as American culture generally? For instance, in 1788, a pair of powerful abolitionist essays appeared, written by a self-described free Black in Baltimore. He took the pen name Othello, and in the second essay, discussing the irrationality of color prejudice, Othello wrote, 'Hath not a Negro eyes, hath not a Negro hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same summer and winter as a white man. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you poison us, do we not die?'" And Sean Wilenz went on to add, 65 years later, Frederick Douglass made abundant use of Shakespeare's Othello in his novel, The Heroic Slave. I wrote back to Sean immediately after Melissa shared his email saying, "I had never heard of this essay. I had never read Frederick Douglass' novel, The Heroic Slave. And I have my work cut out for myself, and I'll be teaching these next year when I teach a seminar on Shakespeare in America." But the two of us corresponded a little bit after my apology. And one of the things that we realized is that this history of Shakespeare and the Black community in America has yet to be fully written. And what is known is scattered further afield and has not been gathered together. One of the things that came to my mind when I read his description of this, "hath not a Negro eyes, hath not a Negro hands," obviously paraphrasing and quoting from Shylock's great speech in The Merchant of Venice, was that the first great African-American Shakespearean, Ira Aldridge, who was not allowed in the 1820s to play Othello in New York City or America and had to emigrate to England and then to Europe to perform Shakespearean roles, turned out to be not just an extraordinary Othello, but a celebrated Shylock as well. And listening to this passage makes me realize that both of these Venice plays, The Merchant of Venice and Othello, have much to do with each other, even as the experience of oppression in quite different ways in the course of American history of Jews and of Blacks bring us in circular fashion back to Shakespeare. One of the most exciting things for me looking forward to a post-pandemic moment is the celebration that you should all put on your calendars for March of 2022. That's going to be held celebrating Duke Ellington's great engagement with Shakespeare based on a half dozen of his plays in the 1950s. He wrote a beautiful composition called Such Sweet Thunder. And I know Columbia is going to be putting together a series of events celebrating this. Even as I know that Langston Hughes and other members of the Harlem Renaissance were engaging in Shakespeare in their own way. So if somebody's listening and looking for an idea for a book, I'm too committed to too many projects to take this on very soon. This is really a story that needs to be written because Shakespeare moving forward has to be a Shakespeare that's not simply an Anglo-American Shakespeare for upscale, overeducated, literate folk, but it has to be a Shakespeare for all Americans. And unless and until it is, we will struggle to overcome that which divides us. Melissa, I want to open it up to questions at this point and then start weaving in other subjects using those questions as a springboard.
Okay, we have a question from Lisa Delaporte. Can we unmute Lisa Delaporte? And here, I think I can click that you can answer live. Did I do that right? Lisa or Emily, maybe I need some tech help with this. No, I'll read it then.
Read it to me.
The question is, can you clarify what the essay is that you teach with Othello?
The essay that I don't teach is the one that Sean Mullins pointed out that was written in 1788. The essay that I do teach about Othello is John Quincy Adams' The Character of Desdemona that was written in the late 1830s. And it seems to me one of the most revealing essays about that play ever written. But there are many, many brilliant essays about Othello. I try to teach as many as I can, including those about Paul Robeson's extraordinary performance, the first time an African-American actor was able to play Othello on Broadway. And that was not until the 1940s, over a century after Ira Aldridge was already playing Othello on the British stage. So Othello really is the central problem now in Shakespeare productions. I can be frank about it. There are many Black actors who don't want to play in this production or in any production. There are many Black directors who do not want to direct this play. And there are many Black scholars who think it should not be taught. And I, again, think that there is great value in it. I've worked on a number of productions of it. It's always fraught, and it always reveals different kinds of fault lines within the culture. And I would be hard-pressed to imagine a production that would not be controversial, but short of violence. Again, I would encourage any theater company to tackle this play at this time.
Okay, we have a question from Olga, and we're going to unmute Olga. Have we got you?
Go ahead, Olga.
Olga, I think you're still muted. Emily, can you loosen her up?
I have asked her to unmute.
There we go. Olga, go ahead.
Hi, Olga. Can you unmute in the lower left, Olga?
Your box says you're not muted. You know what? I will read your question.
Thank you. And maybe that's the best way to go forward, Melissa.
Okay. It says, thank you. We're still figuring this out. We'll be better next time. Thank you for the lecture. You mentioned radical right, but what about radical left? Do you think that cancel culture will reach their hands to Shakespeare in an attempt to abolish him?
That is a great question. And cancel culture is, to me, a quite terrifying entity. There's a very, very thin line between cancel culture and a sense of challenging assumptions that have gone unchallenged for too long. And I think in my own classrooms, I have been aware of and sensitive to both. I flinch when I get a sense of the censoriousness of cancel culture, but I also flinch when I'm called out for values that are unexamined on my part. A few years ago, I taught a class on Richard III, and I read in a slightly histrionic way the opening soliloquy in which Richard speaks about his disability. And he uses that disability as a weapon to rise in power and gain the crown. And a student who was very disturbed about this came up to me after class and explained that it was really insensitive to the disabled how I was doing this. And my gut reaction was, well, these are Shakespeare's words, I am just reading them. But I have to say on reflection that there was an element of truth in what she was saying and in how I was presenting or speaking about disability. So Olga's question is a great one. There's no discounting the dangers of cancel culture. There's no simplifying, as the John Quincy Adams example, I hope, tried to prove, the fact that liberals, as much as conservatives, have biases and prejudices that they are loath to admit to. I should say, and I write about this very briefly in my book, one of the things that happened when Oscar Eustace's production of Julius Caesar was attacked was that the attack came that the left would never, ever have put up with it if a Barack Obama lookalike was assassinated on stage. And in fact, Rob Melrose, who's a wonderful director, had brought a production, a touring production, to New York City 2 years before Oscar's production of Julius Caesar, where a Barack Obama lookalike was in fact assassinated on stage. And the left did not respond with outrage or any anger. So there are different things that trigger the left and right. And in this case, it wasn't really the assassination of Julius Caesar. It was the assassination of somebody who looked like Donald Trump. And what that taught me 4 years later is the conservative movement and the Donald Trump movement are not one and the same. And it wasn't conservatives attacking the theater that day. It was a crowd of people who identified so powerfully with Donald Trump that they would not accept a threat to even a symbolic representation of his being attacked or killed on stage. So one of the things that I had to learn was this was not about conservatives. This was about Trumpians. And I think we'll all have a clearer sense of that. But as Olga's question really underscores, we don't live in easy times. I have to say, I can't speak as freely and as unencumbered in front of an undergraduate class as I did 30 years ago, when I would walk in and would say, we're all gonna make mistakes in here. We're all gonna say things we're gonna regret. What's said in here stays in here. In an internet age where people are recording every word you say, that no longer obtains. So we all have to watch our words and watch our thoughts. And to that extent, cancel culture left or right is inhibiting and not good for an educational system, which has to allow people to make mistakes, especially young people.
Here is another question that said, I know we talk about race, but I'm curious if you get into the conversation about domestic violence when you're addressing Othello.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I mean, the play ends with the suffocation, strangulation of Desdemona. And it is, for me, one of the most unbearable scenes in the play. And one of the things that I explored in my book, I decided to focus on domestic violence in discussing Kiss Me, Kate, which is a wonderful musical from the late 1940s. And I mentioned earlier the scene in which at the end, the heroine must completely subject herself to her husband. And one of the things that happens in the course of that play is she is broken by her husband in Shakespeare's original, not simply in Kiss Me, Kate. And what I mean by broken is all the things we learned about what went on in Guantanamo occur in that play. She is starved for sleep. She has food given to her and taken away. She is disoriented in every possible way. And that is the way you break down a personality. It didn't require 1920s technology to figure that out. Shakespeare's age knew that as well. So I do broach the questions of domestic violence, but Shakespeare is out there. He does not flinch from any of these issues. I have many colleagues who are encouraged or instructed to give trigger warnings before they teach novels or poetry or plays. I just come in my first day of class, hold up a copy of the First Folio and say, it's all here. Domestic violence, racism, anti-Semitism, class warfare, mutilation. If these things make you uncomfortable, there's the door, this is the wrong class for you. Now, that having been said, a few years ago, I taught The Rape of Lucrece, which is about the brutal rape of a Roman wife by the superior of her husband. And I had a student who simply got up and said, I cannot be in a classroom where I am forced to read about a rape of a woman from the perspective of a rapist. And she got up and walked out. And I was very proud of her that she did that. And I understood exactly why she did that. And it was very painful. This stuff is real. I make no concession about that. Shakespeare is volatile. It is often radioactive. And I am somebody who embraces conflict rather than runs from it. And again, in an age of cancel culture, that can be a tricky dance. Let me take one or two more questions, Melissa. These are really fantastic questions.
This is, we need to book you for another night, you know that. Are you familiar with the play Red Velvet, which tells the story of Ira Aldridge? And do you have any opinion on why it was not more broadly produced?
That's a great question. I love that play. I saw it a couple of times, beautifully acted. I met with the writer, I met with the cast. It wasn't marketed in certain ways. It wasn't a Broadway production in the conventional sense. It was a two-act play. I also think, frankly, the fact that Ira Aldridge was with white women was disturbing for a lot of playgoers. And I suppose if everybody knew when Paul Robeson was playing Othello that he was having an affair with his leading lady, who happened also to be Jose Ferrar, Iago's wife at the time, they might not have felt so happy about it. These are just radioactive questions. And I think that subtle radioactivity in the great play Red Velvet, which I'm sure is going to come back in a post-pandemic world, I'm sure of it. It's very strong. I hope I get a chance to teach it as well. Can I take another?
I've got your last question. Is this period of multiple crises, plague, politics, and race unprecedented, or have we seen it before? How much of Shakespeare comes from his having written through a turbulent period too? It seems like you think that Oscar Eustace is our best presenter of Shakespeare. Who is our best actual Shakespeare writing now?
Those are three or four good questions in there. I think Oscar Eustace was the best presenter in 2017. I don't think Oscar Eustace himself thinks he's the best presenter in 2020 or 21 or 22. And to that effect, he brought in Kenny Leon, one of the great Black Broadway directors who mostly specialized in Black drama. And he asked him to do Much Ado About Nothing. And I worked very closely with Kenny on this production. And Kenny decided to stage his play with an all-Black cast, but only using Shakespeare's words and without changing the text, except in the ways that I cut it to fit a 2.5-hour production. And it was extraordinary. I learned more about that play from the perspective of a talented Black director and Black company than I had learned from every production I'd seen, every essay I had read about. So there are things all of us can learn about from Shakespeare from different perspectives. And those perspectives are only going to widen. And let me just end with this. One of the hardest things for me is, for 200 years in this country, the right and the conservatives embraced Shakespeare. And the greatest fear that I have moving forward is that he would be abandoned to the left. Because nothing's going to get more tedious than a bunch of lefty productions of Shakespeare. There has to be a conversation. There has to be pushback. Nothing would please me more than a deeply conservative production of Hamlet, of Macbeth, of Othello, of Much Ado, because these productions have to be in conversation with each other. It's a tug of war. And when one side lets go, the other side falls in the mud. Melissa, let me end on that inelegant metaphor.
That's a fabulous metaphor. Thank you so much. Thank you to everybody who has joined us tonight. Everybody dig yourself out of the snow, stay warm, and stay healthy. Come back in March for Brenda Wineapple. And thank you all, and thank you, Jim.
Thank you, and thanks for the great questions and for your attention and interest.
All right. Good night.